Hey, what it do, sports fans? Welcome to the Sports Live podcast brought to you by Multimedia Live. I'm Sboom Jikeliso, your host, and I will be joined by various guests on this exciting new podcast to discuss the latest ins and outs of the sporting world. We are in our fifth episode of the Sports Live podcast, and we are only getting started when it comes to giving you the best sports content on the World Wide Web. This week, we've turned it up a notch, and we are bringing you some sizzling exclusive interviews and insights. We all know that it's been a tough sporting month for South Africa, but there's always hope at the end of the tunnel. The Proteas let us down at the Cricket World Cup, but the upside is that we will always produce brilliant young cricket talent. And some of the talent was on display in Pretoria when the SA emerging squad faced off against Sri Lanka's emerging squad, as well as the University Sports South Africa, known as USA, in a triangular series. That squad includes the likes of Thando Ntini, Makhaya Ntini's son, Sinethemba Qeshile, Yanaman Malan, Reynard van Tonder, who scored a century against USA last Sunday, and familiar names such as Tony Dzorzi, Tladi Bukako, and Matthew Bretzke. I went down there to watch the kids play, and I must say, I was very impressed by their application to their craft. Although they lost the first match of the series to Sri Lanka by 4 wickets, some of them put up one heck of a fight, such as Thando Ntini, who took 5 for 46 and 2 for 41 in the opening 2 games of the series. Remember, Ntini is only just 18 years old and he turns 19 on July 7th. Myself and Lunga Kupiso managed to catch up with Thando Ntini and Sinethemba Qeshile after their first match in Groenkloof to chat about the pressures on their young shoulders. Listen to this revealing interview.
All right, sitting with Thando Ntini, Sinethemba Qeshile, Sboom Jikeliso to my left. First ODI between SA Emerging and Sri Lankan Emerging. Didn't go exactly according to plan, but there were still positives to take, I'm sure, Thando.
Yeah, definitely. I felt as if the guys worked really hard preparing for the series, and in today's game, we might not have received the result we wanted, but I still felt the guys still played really well.
Sinethemba, you were with the gloves, watching the game from behind the wicket. Some will say it's probably the most tiring thing because you have to be there from ball one till the last ball, but also it gives you sort of an advantage. One, from a fielding perspective, you get to watch all the Sri Lankan batters in how they do, but also you get to get a feel of everyone else in the field in terms of your own side. How would you sum up the game?
Yeah, of course, the bowling side, as a keeper from behind, I think we actually started well up front. I think our bowlers had a lot of confidence in themselves, but obviously when that one partnership got a little bit big, I think we backed away a bit, gave them a leeway to score their runs freely. But I think it's a learning curve from here, and it's something we can improve on in the next game.
You get that opportunity to watch Ntini running in, and how special is that in watching him do what he does?
Yeah, obviously see him every day, so it's not something new to me, so I know what's going on. And I know what to expect from the bowlers.
Thando, maybe to speak now specifically about your numbers from the game, happy with that, surely?
I felt as if my work throughout the whole week paid off today, but I felt as if there are room for improvement in my performance. Might have not been the match-winning performance that we would have wanted, but personally, there is a lot of room for improvement in that performance.
Take 5 wickets and there's still room for improvement.
Yeah.
Right. Improvement in what section, perhaps?
Obviously, in cricket, you don't have the perfect game every single game. So I felt as if at some moments of the game, I could have been more tighter and more economical in that sense. So there's always room for you to get better and work harder, even though you are happy about the performance that you put out on display. So I feel as if there's still more room for me in the weeks to come to actually improve my performances and everything. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to know from you guys, maybe start with you, Snetemba. What do you want to get out of this next few weeks as part of the emerging South African squad? Because a lot of guys, you know, looking at the senior team saying, not the World Cup everybody wanted, guys are retiring, and now there are open places. What do you, in terms of your game, what do you want to get out of this specific period where you're part of the emerging South African team?
Yeah, just obviously not to look too far ahead. Work on things that you struggled last season, but not too much. And hopefully things do come true.
Yeah. Last season you came close to a few first-class centuries until eventually getting one. Are those some of the things you want to improve, converting starts to big scores?
Well, it's not about converting. I feel that it's all about sticking around with the guys. If I had the guys, I could have converted, but obviously the time wasn't great to convert.
Yeah.
So it is what it is.
Same question to you, Tando. What do you want to get out of this period where you're working with the likes of Shukri Conrad and you're around guys, some of them have played internationals such as Osnetemba right here, and some of them have played key roles for their provinces, your Yanaman Malans and all those guys, Tony DeZozi. What do you want to get out of these few weeks against Sri Lanka and USS schools?
Obviously, this being my first series, fresh out of school, so for me it's not to actually try and make a team, but for me to grasp as much information I can from all the senior players in the side and the guys that have played international cricket and grasp from that, and also from this series is to get what I can for me to grow and become a better cricketer and also challenge myself, and who knows what could happen after this series, what call-ups I can get, what future plans that could come up. So for me it's not to look far ahead and to actually focus on the task at hand and try and bring my team to the finish line.
I think you guys both have like incredible futures ahead of you. Do you feel any sort of pressure or do you feel like guys you're getting a little bit more prominence now that the World Cup for South Africa is done and people will be looking into the future and looking at guys like yourselves?
No pressure at the moment. There is nothing to be pressurized about. There's always got to be expectations of you. Pressure is going to be around, obviously being a professional cricketer, but you shouldn't be looking at the pressure moments. So just be yourself and do what you've been doing to get you at this level.
How do you, just going back on pressure, you know, obviously pressure comes as a result of expectations. How do you get yourself into that space where you say, it's not about the results, but me having a reflection on my game and being satisfied with the improvements that I see? How do you get to that space, especially at such a young age in terms of being professional cricketers?
Yeah, obviously the first thing is social media. Social media actually gets to people's head. So if you try to stay away from that, you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
Tando?
For you, Tando.
In terms of handling pressures and everything and expectations, I feel as if you know how good you are and how hard you worked, you don't need to really prove anything to anyone. But to actually play the game, enjoy it, and find those small spaces where you can improve and learn.
Yeah.
So for me, that's my goal, whereas when I play with these guys is to be able to go home and see how much did I learn today, how much growth have I made in the game that we played today. So in taking home the performances that I had today and what I learned, I can say that I took home a lot. I've learned a lot, I've grown a lot today. So for me, I'm happy with that, even though we didn't win, but I'm really happy in terms of that self-reflection and that self-growth.
Fantastic.
All right.
Cool.
Guys.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank
really
you.
I appreciate it.
Now, with the Proteas seemingly down and out at the moment, a lot of people are fearful about the future of cricket. With a slew of international retirements expected at the end of the World Cup, like JP Duminy, Hashim Amla, Dale Steyn, Imran Tahir, there are suddenly openings in the Proteas lineup. The players that will plug the gaps will need to demonstrate that they can take South Africa forward in areas where they've stagnated, such as how to play spin bowling and how to become crafty spin bowlers in their own right. SA emerging coach Shukri Conrad shared his views on SA's spin conundrum and what can be done to make South Africa's batting lineup more complete.
Yeah, look, I think we've got, I mean, you're right in everything you say there. And it's an exciting time to be a young cricketer in South Africa because there's going to be opportunities left, right and centre. Look, Bjorn Fortuin was meant to be part of our programme and he's got a shoulder injury. So he'll probably be part of that South African A side, and yeah, look, it's a tough one because generally as a country we don't produce spinners.
Why is that? Why is it not attractive?
And I'm not saying that we've got poor spinners. I think we've got some really good spinners.
Yeah, but Tabraiz Shamsi is one.
Your Dane Pitts. Mm. People seem to forget about someone like Dane Pitt. There's a George Linder. There's a Keshav Maharaj. But they're all senior guys. These are young boys though, you know. So, and as anybody will tell you, the spinners mature a little bit older. They get a little bit more streetwise.
Yeah.
So we've just got to be a bit more patient with them. But yeah, I still think that we've got quite a few quality spinners in our midst.
And our batsmen in terms of facing quality spin?
Yeah, look, it is a challenge. You only need to look at the domestic record and how well the spinners do, someone like Bjorn Fortuin, how well he does.
Yeah.
And some of the problems that our batters face when they face him. And that is also a work in progress. But I think it's a whole mindset that needs to be changed and we need to be taking on a much more aggressive way of playing, a smarter way of playing. We need to introduce spinners through our age groups as well, so that the spinner doesn't feel he's only there to make up the numbers type of thing. So it's a host of things that need putting right. We've just got to be patient with some of these kids.
A while ago, CSA had this Spinners Academy, but it seemed like a summer program whereby it was just to get guys spin ready for the upcoming tournaments and the upcoming tours at the ready. I remember guys like JP Duminy went in and tried to get their lines in shape or their technique right when facing spinners. But do we need a dedicated academy? We've got great academies all over the country. One fantastic one just up the road here at Tux, one at Forte. Do we need a dedicated spin academy, not just for guys that actually want to perfect the craft as spin bowlers, but for our batsmen who, if you look at the limited overs game, it's dominated by spin wizards. Shakib Al-Hassan is one example who's dominating at the World Cup.
You're right. And yes, we have every year the guys go on call it a spin camp that they go to India. The guys leave in a couple of weeks' time again for that. And we send like 8 spinners on that camp and 4 or 5 batters go on that camp every single year. And it's also part of what we try and do during the season where we have little camps. I have little camps with guys. Right. And I get ex-players in, your Robin Petersons, your Paul Harris's, to work with the spinners. And like you rightly said, the batters to play against those spinners. But it is a massive mindset that we need to change in terms of how aggressively we need to play the spin.
Yeah.
And when I talk aggressively, I don't only talk 4s and 6s. Our biggest problem today was we didn't rotate the strike well enough, so we block ourselves into a hole and then we try and smash our way out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but again, that's all part of the learning process for these young men.
Fabulous.
Okay.
Thanks so much. And one of the biggest bugbears I've had with the Proteas is their reluctance to develop and give full faith to left-arm seamers. Immediately after the Proteas' 2015 World Cup failure in New Zealand, I interviewed former Aussie paceman Jeff Lawson about the importance of a left-armer in ODI cricket. South Africa didn't really know what to do with a talent like Wayne Parnell back then, who could bat, and they've mucked about with Byron Hendricks, who I feel should have been in the original squad list headed for England. I have a real bee in my bonnet about this issue because we have never really given much importance to left-arm seamers in the recent past, although six out of the 11 past Cricket World Cup editions have been dominated by left-arm seamers such as Wasim Akram, Chaminda Vaz, Zaheer Khan, Mitchell Johnson, and most recently Trent Bolt and Mitchell Starc. We've seen already in this year's tournament that Starc and Bolt are up there in the wickets column, followed closely by Amir Khan, Wahab Riaz, and Sheldon Cottrell of the West Indies. We managed to catch up to Chaminda Vaz, who is in South Africa as the coach of Sri Lanka's emerging squad, and we asked him to share his thoughts about the impact of left-arm seamers on ODI bowling.
I think so. Left-armers are so special, and you need to have left-armers in a team to create the angles, and they're so special, and all the left-armers playing in all other countries are exceptional, doing really well. Yeah. And I'm sure that, you know, all the left-armers are doing pretty well because they are special.
Yeah. Do you have any sort of special talents in your team?
We have two left-armers and one under-19 guy.
Yeah.
He's playing for under-19. So we brought him here to adjust for conditions, and he has been doing really well in under-19 during Pakistan tour. And I'm very pleased with his performance, and I'm sure that he has more potential to play for the Sri Lanka.
It's a jam-packed episode 5, and we have only just brushed the surface. There's too much sport going on at the moment and too little time. You know by now that if you want to catch up to more up-to-date sports content, you have to go to timeslive.co.za, sowetanlive.co.za, or bdlive.co.za. Of course, we cannot ignore Bafana Bafana. Although they lost their AFCON opening game against the Ivory Coast last week, they redeemed themselves against Namibia on Friday. A couple of days ago, they faced Morocco in the final Group D clash. We caught up with Mark Striker Stradom, who is in Egypt after Monday's clash, and he gave us his reaction to the game against the Atlas Lions. Listen to this.
Yeah, no, we see, you see the reaction from home. You understand people's emotions. You know, going into the game, no one gave Bafana a chance of a draw. No one. Everyone said this team, Morocco team, are too good. So now to be hysterical as South Africans that we didn't play for a win when we came within 40 seconds of the end of normal time of a draw. I just think there needs to be some sense of perspective. I don't think people having they see Morocco on TV, they don't see Morocco up close, they don't see how good they are. Morocco against Ivory Coast, the way they played, the way we played against Namibia, there just seemed absolutely no chance Bafana could get a result. And yet, there still were some factors in our favor. The fact that the match was a 6 p.m. kickoff and that it was going to be played in pretty hot conditions, not quite as hot, nowhere near as hot as a 4:30 p.m. kickoff, but hot nonetheless. And that Morocco need, if they're going to win the tournament, they have to play 7 games. So they have to conserve somewhere. They'd qualified for the next round. They needed a draw to get through to as group winners, which is what they wanted. So they were going to conserve a bit of energy against us, and they did. So that gave us a bit of a hint of an opportunity. Having said that, South Africans maybe need a little bit of a sense of perspective. Stuart Baxter needs a lot of a sense of perspective. Because, okay, looking at the Morocco game in isolation, yeah. So then he picks a pretty attacking lineup, and you think, wow, you know, He's got Mokotjo next to Zungu in midfield. He's brought in Serrero. So you're actually thinking, wow, now he's picked an attacking lineup. Williams comes back at goalkeeper, which is good because he's been on form. Probably our best starting 11 of the tournament so far. Absolutely, I think it was. And then the first half actually is the best 45 minutes, and a lot of South Africans will say, will you know, who are slamming this performance, don't seem to be taking into account that the first 45 minutes was the best 45 minutes of the tournament for us. We had the structure back that we showed against Ivory Coast, and we had a bit of an attack, and we actually rattled Morocco to the point. You know, we didn't put them on the back foot. This is Morocco. Yeah, I mean, this is a heck of a good team coached by Hervé Renard. You can't throw everything at Hervé Renard. I think he'll figure out exactly how to counter that. But we played a really, really sensible first half. We actually attacked a bit. We had that structure. It was the most polished 45 minutes from Bafana in the tournament so far. We came out in the second half pushing for an early goal. We didn't get it. And Kiza had a shot that flashed past the post. And then this is where Stewart's tactics are actually kind of inexcusable. And, well, not kind of. They're actually inexcusable. And this is where Bafana lost the plot a bit, which is that suddenly then actually having Morocco a little bit rattled and actually coming out and almost bossing them at the start of the second half for the first 5 minutes, then we went into our shell. And then if it wasn't an instruction, Stewart should have rectified it. If it wasn't instruction, it's the wrong instruction. We started to play very, very deep. We started to play for the draw at that stage. And that actually is courting trouble against a team with Morocco's frontline, because Hervé Renard named his absolute full-strength frontline, the one that had picked apart Ivory Coast. And we then started to be camping in our half, and Morocco basically having the space to run at us without having to kill themselves, which is exactly what they wanted. Because they didn't want to kill themselves in this game. They've got bigger games coming up. They just played a bruising encounter against Ivory Coast. They needed to conserve and refresh a bit. Basically, when we finally even got out of our half, and we would then basically the support players were sitting so far back that Morocco could just snap back into our half. And that really, really is not a tactic. That's a counterproductive tactic, even if you're playing for a draw. Because at the end of the day, whether they scored in the 90th minute, whether they scored in the 75th minute, they eventually scored. And it was from that, having sitting way too deep. And the irregularity of chances, Bak Boussoufa had already hit the post with a thunderous shot. And Yesri had been put through. He'd rounded Williams on the right. He had an awkward angle. He slipped on the ball. He could have scored. We should have, with those chances, actually realized this tactic is not working. We really, really, really need to try to get back into Morocco's half, even to just attack them sporadically, just so that they can't have the freedom to just sit in our half the way they were. So, yeah, I think that's where maybe that's the tactics where Stewart got it wrong.
Right, to round up the conversation nicely for us, I've roped in one of Sunday Times' most premier sports writers, Khanyiso Chwaku. Chwaku Stan himself, welcome to the podcast, buddy.
How's it?
All good, man. Nice to have you. There's so much that we could go through, but I feel like we have to touch on the cricket conundrum. Here we are sitting on the precipice of real disaster, a World Cup where we've only managed two victories against Afghanistan and Sri Lanka, whom we already beat 5-0 at home. I don't even want to count those two victories as real in a sense. And we're the only team that played friendlies, only real contender that played friendlies, while the rest of the World Cup challengers, your Australians, your New Zealands, your Indians, your Pakistans, even Bangladesh, we're still in competition by the late stages. And here we are, a non-entity. How have you made of the World Cup?
It so happens that every country is due a bad World Cup.
Yeah.
If you look at how South Africa have competed since 1992 in particular, in 1992, they were surprise semi-finalists. 1996, they won every group game, but the first proper challenge they met in the West Indies in the quarterfinals, they lost. Selections there were an issue. I mean, Paul Adams played ahead of Alan Donald. I mean, in 1999, I mean, probably that was probably the best World Cup squad we've assembled. Those were difficult batting conditions. But again, in that World Cup, South Africa's batting didn't deliver. A lot was left on Jacques Callis's and Lance Klusener's shoulders in particular. And again, there was that semi-final for the ages. A lot of people take out the fact that South Africa choked in a specific game, but if you look past what that round that didn't happen, it's still 20 years on. That is probably the best ODI I ever played. So I from my perspective, I don't speak on anyone else's behalf. I've learned to deal with what happened in that game. But I look at...
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, I speak for myself. But again, I think being a journalist now and understanding how the game ebbs and flows, I've come to appreciate...
Are you numb to the pain or are you desensitized?
It's not desensitized. I pulled my South African self, my South Africanness back.
Okay, so you're removed from the situation.
Yes, and then I looked, I watched the game.
Yeah.
As and I realized that was a gem of an ODI. People will look at 438. 438 was a great game, one of the greatest games for a different.
But there was nothing at stake, though.
Yes, but if you look at that game in particular, sorry to digress, but
no worries.
That game was had everything. It had. There's great bowling from both teams. I mean, Alan Donald and Sean Pollock bowled out of their skins. Michael Bevan and Stephen Waugh batted out of their skins. South Africa got off to a great start. Herschel Gibbs looked all the money to make up for that dropped catch in the Headingley game. But then he got one of the balls of one-day cricket from Shane Warne that pretty much actually froze the team. Gary Kirsten froze with that sweep. Hansie Cronje, the late Hansie Cronje, got a stink of a decision. The ball came off his foot. He didn't hit it. But in the space of two overs, Shane Warne actually dragged his country back into the World Cup. You see, so again, there was a recovery of sorts in the specific game. There were runouts. There were everything. So if you look at that game in particular, if you take out the choke, because in terms of chokes, that was a game that South Africa was supposed to win and they didn't. But it was a classic cricket game. You sit back and you look at some of the contests we've seen in this World Cup, you realize that
nothing still comes close to that.
Precisely.
Dude,
I mean,
there was an 8,000-word article written on that game, and I read it in probably less than 15 minutes. Yeah, exactly.
It still didn't make sense to you. And if you look at, there was Ireland's heist against England, where Kevin O'Brien scored what still remains the fastest World Cup 100. You have that very same World Cup, England nearly chased down 338 against India. The game was tied in Bangalore. So every World Cup, I mean, South Africa played in one of the games of the World Cups in that semi-final against New Zealand. So
you could say that.
And I think if you look back at what Simba Banisa wrote in a column, I think it was 2 weeks back for City Press, you realize that South Africa have pretty much found every way to exit the World Cup. They've choked. They've played badly. The weather's intervened.
Is it disappointing tactics. That we've actually exited a World Cup? Like there's been no lightning striking the field.
I think
our next trick in the circus show that has been
the protest
at World Cup.
I think in particular you reach a point where Father Time and Mother Nature do what they need to do. I think everything that happens in this world is organic. If you look at South Africa's ebbs and flows in World Cups, South Africa semi-finalists in 96. I mean in 92, quarterfinalists in 96, semi-finalists in 99. At some point, South Africa would do a bad World Cup. I mean, if you look back at the 2003 World Cup, there were a number of questionable selections. The cricket played in the big games left a lot to be desired. South Africa, I mean, there was a dropped catch. Brian Lara was dropped at Newlands. He went on to score a match defining, what for South Africa was a tournament defining 100. Again, there was a dropped catch. Stephen Fleming was dropped here at the Wanderers. He went on to score what remained his highest ODI score, and that was a proper pretext of how
50 odd.
No, it made, I think it was 137. Yes, but Tim and Nathan Astle made, the rain intervened, but they made light work of what at the time was a very stiff total. But also it gave us a precursor of day games with the Wanderers, because that game was 3 years before 438. And then there was the rain at Kingsmead, where again
misread the sheet.
Again, so then in 2007, Brave Cricket didn't work out. A lot of people refer to that St. Lucia semi-final loss against Australia as a choke. But again, you realize that South Africa were handsomely beaten in St. Kitts. where they Matthew Hayden scored what was in the fastest World Cup 100. They tallied up 380. And South Africa gave it a good first. I remember there was AB at the time was a neither hero. They played, made a few test matches, but did yet to announce himself as an ODI player. In that game, he served notice of how good an ODI player he could be. He made a 70 ball 92. Yet he got run out by Shane Watson from deep finding a direct hit. His wicket changed this thing, changed the entire complexion of the game and the entire complexion of the tournament. You see. So, and that was probably the one test Australia had, because that was one game where they had a rabbit in the headlight, a deer in the headlights moment after that Australia coasted through the tournament. Yeah, and they'd identified that group game as the toughest game they could play. And they brushed aside South Africa. And after that, they pretty much coasted through the tournament. Remember, the South African, the very same tournament, should have coasted in against Sri Lanka in Guyana. Then Malinga 4-4 happened. South Africa ended up winning by one wicket.
Yeah.
You see.
Yeah.
And then there was... same place, Providence in Guyana. South Africa lost to Bangladesh. A Bangladesh side. There was
low total as well.
No, just 250. Just 251 for 8.
At the time. Bangladesh.
Yes, Mohammed Ashraful was at the heart of the betting, but four key players who were critical in the game for Bangladesh in 2007 were again critical components in South Africa, in Bangladesh beating South Africa. Shakib Al Hassan, Tamim Iqbal, Mushfiqur Rahim, Mashraf Murtaza. Those four were youngsters in their team in the 2007 side.
And look at them now.
They are the core of this team, of Bangladesh's team. So, I mean, and also again, Asian cricket traditions are very, very different. I mean, they place a lot of emphasis and faith in talented youngsters, and they give them as much leeway to succeed. And I read a piece on ESPN Cricket Info where Mark Nicholas said Shakib Al Hassan is underrated and understated, in particular with emphasis on understated.
I think if
Shakib played for Australia, England,
or India,
he would have been like
up there with the Jacques.
I mean, if there's an all rounder in the world that can punch toe-to-toe with Ben Stokes, it's Shakib. There's no
Definitely.
One else. Yes,
yeah.
There's no one
yeah,
else.
Yeah, yeah.
And what makes Shakib such a premier all-rounder is that he's a spin bowler. You hardly get a spin bowling all-rounder.
Yeah.
Yes, he's good in his batting craft. He's good in his bowling craft.
Yeah,
and he happens to be a very good fielder. So you move to the 2011 World Cup for South Africa in particular. They didn't have a very difficult group. I mean, they were the only team to beat the eventual champions, India, in what was a classic.
Chasing a 300-plus score, yeah.
Again in Nagpur. That was one of the games of the tournament. They also lost.
I think so. Yeah. I think that again, was great. Again, I thought that you beat India in India.
Yes.
Chasing down 300.
Yes.
Why is it impossible for us to follow through on such moments? And why aren't we transcendent? Like, that should be the game where we put India away, like, psychologically. Like, Australia. Australia in the 1999 Edgbaston game.
Yes.
They put us away psychologically in that game. You know, even though we've become more competitive as a nation against Australia because those greats have retired, right? But it's there. It's in the back of the mind. I would go so far as to say even New Zealand have got a psychological edge, because in five World Cup contests against New Zealand, we've never beaten them.
Yes.
And it's weird because they're the ones that confirm our exits every single time.
Yes. I think to answer that question, again, you live in the moment.
Yeah.
But it's a question of whether you place too much emphasis on that moment. That World Cup game in particular was, it came at a time when South African cricket in particular felt that they were competing on a proper even keel with Australia. Remember, South Africa in 1992, their first World Cup game, they handsomely beat Australia in Sydney. Then Australia came here and we actually went to Australia first in 1993-94. We did reasonably well in that tri-series, but we lost. We took a lead in the best of three, but went on to lose the final two games. A trend was, at the time, it wasn't seen then, but a trend was starting to emerge.
Yeah,
a pattern was starting to emerge in terms of how Australia somehow always find it within themselves to beat Australia. Also, they were starting to settle on a core group of players would become synonymous in South Africa's defeats.
Yeah.
Then Australia came in that very same 1993-94 season. South Africa took an early 3-1 lead in a best-of-eight series, but Australia fought back to draw the series 4-1. And then Australia came here in 1996-97. They beat us in the Test Series. And in the midst of what was an ODI, right, for them, because they lost the World Cup final in 96. Then they went on a spiral where they lost ODI series in Sri Lanka. They couldn't put a foot right in the Titan Cup.
In fact, Shane Warne was in danger of missing out on the 99 World Cup squad.
Yes, in particular.
Yeah.
Yes, and Australia in 1996 weren't able to put a foot right in limited overs cricket. I mean, Pakistan and West Indies went to what was the Carlton and United series. They actually beat Australia handsomely and they competed in the final to a point where they decided, then the Australian Cricket Board decided that they now need to start looking at having separate test and ODI squads. And they trialed it in South Africa and it worked. And they beat South Africa 4-3 in that series. So what then happened was you started to get a pattern that emerged where South Africa would win the routine and the mundane games, but when it counted, and it happened in that same tri-series in Australia beat Australia in every game in
then
the tri-series.
In the best of three,
they won the first one, but they lost the last two games that counted. So a pattern was developing. And when it came to the World Cup, South Africa should have won that Headingley Super Sixes game, which would have confirmed Australia's exit. Herschel Gibbs dropped that catch. Australia turnover would have been a tough chase should into an them. Easy win.
I mean,
and
again,
then the semi-final happened.
People will say should have beaten Zimbabwe, which would have avoided Australia altogether. But let's bring it back. Let's bring it back to the here and now. Here we are, Proteas. What's going on? What are the solutions? Because now I feel that cricket as a sport, as an entity, is at stake.
Yes.
And that the Proteas are merely the shop window. Because this is my theory about the Proteas.
Yes.
After 2015, like, I'm like you, my nervous system kind of shut down.
Yes.
And I was unable to take whatever they dish up at every World Cup. So I was kind of prepared for this in 2019. So now, I feel the Proteas in the sporting ecosystem, they've slotted right in where they belong. They are the Netherlands.
Yes.
Right? They are the Netherlands. They are, I'd say, in rugby, I'd equate them to maybe Wales. You know,
Or the All Blacks before the 2011 World Cup.
Not even then, because that All Blacks before 2011 World Cup was too dominant of an entity. The Proteas have never dominated cricket as much as the All Blacks did in the intervening years before the World Cup. I would equate them to Wales because, again, Wales have a stumbling block against the Bucks. You know,
recent
results are good. They favor Wales.
Yes.
But come to a World Cup, we know they should have beaten the Bucks at their last World Cup. They should have beaten them in New Zealand in 2011.
Yes.
So, yeah, I feel like we've slotted in there and that's our comfort spot, right? Now, talk to me about cricket as it stands right now, because we are seeing the retirement of a lot of players that will, in retrospect, be considered great. Steele Steyn, Imran Tahir, I feel could slot in that category because now he's our leading wicket taker at World Cups. Of course, AB de Villiers is gone in rather mysterious circumstances or nefarious circumstances, however you want to put it. Where do we stand? How do we move forward?
Look, the beauty about having terrible World Cups is that whatever denial you had about your current situation, it puts everything into perspective. I mean, a lot of bets were hedged in terms of what kind of performance was expected from the senior players, and they did not deliver. It so happened. So, and it's led to a lot of people saying that certain senior players shouldn't have gone. Hashim Amla being an example, you know, JP Dumini being an example. But again, you know, it's always difficult to predict a lot of these things where you feel that if you're not going to pick Hash, who else
is
going to go?
Yeah, that's the thing.
You see, so
give me someone who was breaking down the door.
Yes, and in this particular case, if Reeza Hendricks had an outstanding early 2018, 2019 season, you would have made a case of, do we pick this guy because he's in form or do we rely on Hashim Amla's class? And unfortunately, Hashim Amla's class didn't push through.
Yeah,
the same applied with JP, where JP was picked as a senior player and in the critical games, in India and England, he didn't deliver. And you expect your senior players to put their hands up, but a pattern prevalent in the past repeated itself. So you ask yourself a question that should not we have backed younger players here, players who may have come with little fear and just play the game.
Yeah.
Because if you look at how Rassie van der Tessen played, Rassie would sum up the situation.
I've loved
you
how
see, he summed
played.
Up the situation
he blocked out the noise.
He'd play what was in front of him. You see. So again,
he seemed to be in another planet while everyone else was losing their heads.
Fair enough. And the thing is, Aiden Markram deserved to be at the World Cup because he did the requisite.
He had the runs.
Yes.
That complemented
the
selection.
There is a core that that can be worked, because I actually put out a 6-year plan and someone asked why, and I said, you need to look past one World Cup edition, because the World Cup is not, it may be the ICC event showpiece.
Yeah.
But you also need to look at the fact that there could be another Champions Trophy. There is the 2020 World Cup. The next 2020 World Cup is in October, is in November next in Australia. So your next plans should be formulated in terms of when you do your ODI, you're actually not even ODI, you're limited overs squad, cricket planning. You have these two tournaments in mind.
Right. Now, that on that point, I don't want to lose you there.
Yes.
An SAA ODI team has been picked and is going to India. It's being captained by Themba Bavuma.
Yes.
Now, give me your thoughts on that, because a lot of people feel that Themba has been unjustly done by in the South African limited overs
team
setup, because he came in, scores 100 against Ireland,
yes,
and we don't see him again.
I think Themba is a victim of his own success, and I'll say that he's a victim of his own test success, because his test match engagements haven't quite allowed him to play as much limited overs cricket as he would like. Because Themba is a bona fide test match player that is proven beyond
but
doubt.
But why can't we look at Themba as just a player like we do Aiden Markram?
That's the thing.
I'm actually getting to that point.
The thing with Aiden's limited over struggles have actually allowed him to go back down and play as much cricket as he possibly can for the Titans.
Right.
Yes. And what Themba is,
and therefore he can
actually
show
he can have a consistent run that allows him to put together the necessary runs. In the time that Aiden has been able to mark himself out as a serious and limited overs player,
Themba's
been busy playing test cricket.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense, because Themba only got his first class or list A 100.
Yes.
At back end of the season that's just ended now.
And that's the thing. So it's not like Themba didn't score runs. He didn't have enough of a consistent run in his best batting position with the Lions to say, hey guys, I think I may be an option to look at here as a limited overs batsman. And I think the way that he played for the Lions, for the Highveld Lions, the Momentum One Day Cup and in the T20 and in the CSA franchise T20 series, you now realize that Themba now has put himself in the market as limited overs batsman, and people may say that Themba was done by. Again, you need to look at the weight of. If you look at a guy like Riza in particular, Riza would say that he was hard done by because he did all the requisite work at every level to get into where he needs to be.
Right.
I mean, people look at Rassie and they may say, but Rassie hasn't played enough cricket for the Lions. But if you look at Rassie's work in particular, Rassie scored runs in every format. For the Lions, he's top scored for the Lions in 4-day cricket. He's top scored for the Lions in red in the 50 over version.
Yeah.
He's top scored for the Lions in the franchise 20 series, and he was the Mzansi Super League top run scorer. There's nothing that he hasn't done for his particular teams at every franchise level. So he literally kicked the door down.
Yeah.
And when he got into the national team, he stayed in. So again, there's a core that can easily be built. But again, you need Cricket South Africa to get the players to buy into their vision, number one. Because I actually thought that Otis had a very good plan where the players just cheated the World Cup like every other tournament.
Yeah,
like just go in there, live in the specific moment that you're in. Because a lot of people have been throwing the word choke around. Mm. I mean, in one of my cricket groups, I had to actually put guys in line and tell them.
There's nothing about this.
We actually have to play well to choke. Yeah, we actually have to get into a winning position to choke.
Outright abject failure, bro.
Yes.
There's nothing to choke about this. In fact, it would be a flattery.
Yes, to call it a choke. Yes. Nah. Like I remember Gary Kirsten said in 2013 when South Africa lost to England at the Oval in the semi-final of the Champions Trophy. He called that a choke, and I couldn't understand when he called it a choke because they didn't play well enough to choke.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Chocks, before I let you go, a lot's been going on and a lot will probably go on before this comes out, but I need you to give us one of our weekly features of the week, the upset of the week and the playmaker of the week, stacked with cricket and AFCON, which is on the go at the moment. Here are your options for upset of the week. I'll start you off with Madagascar beating Nigeria 2-0. Sri Lanka beating England at the Cricket World Cup. Pakistan beating New Zealand, also at the Cricket World Cup. And Megan Rapinoe's... No. That should be on Playmaker of the Week. Yeah, so here are your options. Madagascar beating Nigeria.
The thing is, to the Cricket World, it's a World Cup. So England beat... Sri Lanka beating England wasn't a surprise. But that... Madagascar, there's a Chiefs player whose name that we still battle to pronounce.
Just call him Dax.
Dax, yes.
Yeah. Cool.
That is a shock.
Madagascar for the upset of the week. Right, let's get into Playmaker of the Week. This is where the USA's Megan Rapinoe's performance against France for the USA scoring 2 goals at the Women's World Cup quarterfinals comes in. Your other options is Jaguars making their first Super Rugby final. They'll play the Crusaders. Percy Tau's Man of the Match performance against Namibia set up the Zungu goal. Trent Bolt's hat-trick against Australia. Mo Shami's hat-trick against Afghanistan. And Baba Azam's 101 not out to help Pakistan beat New Zealand. Oh,
I have to go Jags.
Jags!
I have to go Jags.
What's with the bias? This is rugby bias, right?
No, I like what...
That's a forward
no, pass. No, it isn't. The US, the women's team, they've been a...
host France.
Still...
It's Playmaker.
Still.
2 goals.
Still. It's if you followed women's football, US have been a constant force. The first time the US women's team came into my existence as a sports person was in the 1999 World Cup.
That they hosted. Yeah.
When Brian Chastain scored that penalty. Again, it's just that they...
Why Jaguars?
Look, I've been following the Jaguars constantly this season. I was at Loftus Versfeld when their run started. That's where they...
Didn't they put 50 on... They put 50 on the Sharks.
That was the week before. In that game,
they came back from 28-something.
They were trailing. They were trailing by 12 points.
Okay.
Domingo Miotti came in the 69th minute.
Yeah.
Scored 2 tries and nailed a difficult conversion. And the Jaguars won that game by 22 points to 20. Since that game, the Jaguars only lost 1 game to the Highlanders. They've quieted everyone. They went to Durban. They put Sharks team. Yes, they put a coach and the team that consists of his sons in their place properly at home.
And the Sharks had just put 50 at Ellis Park against the Lions. So that
they put
that
40 plus. And ever since then, they have been steady. They did something that South African teams have battled to do, go to Australia and New Zealand, and win there and make it look like it's just passing
last
the sugar.
Last year, they actually won 4 in a row.
No, it was 3 from 4. They're 3 from 4. Yeah. If you look at the Jaguars, they've done 6 from 8 in Australia and New Zealand in the past 2 seasons.
Jeez, that's amazing.
And then people say it's a surprise that they've made the final. And I also, what rugby have you been watching?
Right. Chokustan, we'll have to leave it there, but it's been a great chat. Fantastic insights on cricket. We'll definitely be following your writing as we go along. Hopefully, there will be a great future for the Proteas going forward. Cheers, bud.
Shab.
That's it from me, Sbu Mjikeliso, and you've been listening to the Sports Live podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. Do also catch us on timeslive.co.za, as well as Sowetan Live, Business Live. We are also on Iono FM, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you get your podcasts. It could be Spotify, Stitcher, CastBox, Pocket Cast, wherever. To connect with us, please use the hashtag SportsLive. Share your comments with us at TimesLive or at SowetanLive on Twitter. A big thank you goes out to the Multimedia Live team led by Scott Peter Smith and producer Paige Muller, as well as the Tiso Black Star Digital Sports Department headed by Mninawa Mchana Ntloko. Our sound and audio mixer is Innocent Manyike. From us at the Sports Live podcast, it's goodbye for now.